Hey, all you terrible people. Be sure to stay tuned to hear a promo from one of our friends.
Hi, I'm Jules from Riddle Me That True Crime.
I'm Robin Warder from The Trail Went Cold, and Jules and I want to tell you a little bit about a case that means a great deal to us. The death of 9-month-old baby Jacob Landine on April the 10th, 1987 in Socorro, New Mexico.
The day prior to his death on April 9th, baby Jacob was being watched by his mother Brenda's new boyfriend John, not his real name, in his mobile home on 1453 Fatima Drive. While John was babysitting Jacob, Jacob would incur what would be his second head injury in a period of weeks. The prior head injury was a subdural hematoma, or brain bleed, and it was serious enough that it needed to be lanced to take pressure off baby Jacob's brain while being monitored by doctors over the course of several days.
The circumstances surrounding how Jacob was injured and subsequently died are murky at best, with the suspect giving multiple versions of the events of the day, ranging from Jacob choking and accidentally hitting his head while trying to dislodge a cookie, to Jacob falling and John returning to see the injured infant.
The suspect also reportedly confessed to officers that he was indeed responsible, but there is no paper or audio record of this confession in the police file. The reasons given by the DA for not pursuing the case are confusing as well, with one of the reasons being that they were worried that John would file charges against the state.
It was the opinion of the doctors that baby Jacob was struck in the head and this was no accident. In the years to follow, John goes on to sexually abuse young Eric, as well as physically abusing his mother Brenda, and emotionally abusing and isolating them both, making their world very small.
During the autopsy, layers of abuse seem to be present. A healing rib fracture from around the time of the first head injury is also discovered. It's impossible to say exactly when the injury took place, but what is clear is that someone was abusing young Jacob, and that person was most likely John.
Eric Landine, Jacob's brother, has been fighting to get justice for him. However, he faces some obstacles such as the statute of limitations of 6 years on second-degree murder that State Representative Bill Rehm has petitioned to have overturned.
Join Robin and I, as well as criminologist Dr. Ashley Wellman, an investigative expert, a legal expert, a forensic psychiatrist, as well as Jacob's brother Eric, as we explore all angles of this case and try to bring awareness, understanding, and hopefully, ultimately, justice for Jacob.
The series starts on March the 1st. Tune in on your favorite podcast app.
Welcome to Terrible People Doing Terrible Things. I'm Amanda, and I'm a licensed psychologist who enjoys studying the worst of humanity.
And I'm Laura, a true crime and horror fan who enjoys researching dark and twisted stories. And boy, do I have one for you today.
Yay!
So I'm going to tell you about Catherine Mary Knight. Catherine was born in October 1955, and she would be the first Australian woman to be sentenced to life with no parole.
Okay, yeah.
No chance of parole. Zero.
None. Like, none, yeah.
She ain't getting out. Catherine was from the town of Tenterfield in New South Wales. She was one of 8 children, and she was also one of twins. I don't know how you say that. Like a twin?
One of a set of twins?
She had a twin.
I don't know.
Yeah, she had a twin. So her mother, Barbara, had also had 4 boys with a previous marriage and another son with Ken Knight, who is Catherine Knight's father.
Okay.
And from what I could make of the story, Barbara had the children with Ken and then her marriage with Jack Rohan fell apart. So there was some messing around and some, you know, some stuff going on.
Yeah. Okay. Some shenanigans on the side there.
Some shenanigans on the side for sure. And 2 of her sons that she had with Jack, 2 of his sons, I guess, stayed with him when, you know, him and Catherine parted ways.
Okay.
And then the other 2 of his sons went to live with an aunt. They're really big about splitting up kids. I don't know.
Yeah.
They just, like, he kept 2 of his favorite, I guess, and the other ones went to an aunt.
Yeah.
That's what it sounds like to me.
Meeny, miny, mo. Goodbye.
I like you and you. You can fuck off.
Yeah.
So Ken, her father, worked at an abattoir, which is a slaughterhouse, and he was a slaughterman.
Oh, okay.
So these are, like, really big, high-processing meat places.
Yes.
I think when her dad was doing it, it was a little bit less, like, low-key, and it turned into more, like, a factory working, like, later on.
Okay.
To where, you know, it's just, like, pigs in, cows out, you know, just chopping up and murdering everything. And he traveled with his family wherever he could find work. between New South Wales and Queensland's areas, which are a couple of hundred, I keep wanting to say miles, kilometers apart.
It's kilometers.
Yeah. Okay. Which I don't ask me. I don't know how many miles it is. I don't know.
I think it would be.
I don't know. It was a couple hours drive. Like it took some time.
Yeah. Yeah.
So later in 1969, they settled in Aberdeen because there was steady work for abattoirs there.
Okay.
And Catherine being around this environment and like this was her life and stuff, naturally, she wanted to be an abattoir too, which she did.
Okay.
When she turned 16, she joined her father at the Aberdeen Abattoir. Aberdeen Abattoir. Aberdeen Abattoir.
Abadabba.
Abadabba. So as you can assume, this was a really heavily male-dominated field.
Yeah.
Especially like at the time. But she became as tough as any dude she worked with. And she was known to never back down, always have a knife on hand ready to use. And she would challenge anyone that pissed her off to armed combat. No one ever took her up on it.
I wasn't expecting that, but yeah.
Yeah. It goes from here, man. Just wait.
Oh, man.
So obviously nobody took her up on that because nobody wants to fight a crazy woman with a knife.
No.
And her most prized possession was a set of boning knives that she had gotten. And she hung these precious knives. And Amanda, just a real quick multiple choice question here. Where did she hang the knives? Was it above the stove? Above the toilet, above her bed, or above the fireplace?
Bed.
Yeah, you know it.
Yeah.
It was above her bed.
She fucked up. Yeah.
She kept them there so she could see them while she went to sleep and that they would always be handy and nearby if she needed them. And she continued to do this everywhere she lived up until she was arrested.
Okay.
So this bitch has a set of, and we're talking, you know, boning knives. Really sharp.
Ooh, yeah.
Sharp knives.
Yeah.
So that's odd, you know.
A little bit.
But hey.
A little
just
bit.
Just a little.
Yeah.
Just a little.
Just a smidge.
Just a tiny bit. So in 1973, she met 22-year-old truck driver David Kellett. And once she turned 18, she moved in with him.
Okay.
They were married in 1974, the next year. And there was a rumor that she tried to strangle him on their wedding night because he wouldn't have sex with her enough.
Okay. Yeah.
Times.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think so, I remember hearing something about that and being like, damn.
Yeah. So she was like, this is not adequate lovemaking and I'm going to strangle you. So that's weird. Great way to start your wedding.
And she's like that meme. I don't know if you've seen it of the, it's a lion and then the lioness behind him and she's like biting his balls.
Oh.
And the explanation for it is like, he's not putting out enough. Like, and I think there's a scientific explanation for like, lioness wanting sex like constantly and they will like get your balls if you don't put
give
out
me your balls.
Yeah.
Just another reason to love lionesses.
I know.
Well, after a while David started working with her at the abattoir and he was actually the one in charge of slaughtering the pigs and she would visit him often to watch him work. So she loved watching him kill pigs with a stun baton or something. I think it's one of those, the shooty thing for cows, like the in the head.
Oh, yes.
You know what I mean? The air pressure.
Air gun?
Yeah.
Air?
Something like that.
I don't know.
But she loved it. And in 1976, she had their first child. And David couldn't handle her violent, possessive behavior anymore. So he split town with another woman.
Yeah, okay.
Which was probably a really good idea.
Yes.
As you can imagine, Catherine did not take this well.
Okay.
She was severely, severely depressed and had no one to take it out on.
Mm.
So she took it out on her 2-month-old child, Melissa.
Ah, damn it.
So she took her to the train line and she left her in the middle of the tracks to be run over by the next train that was coming. Luckily, Melissa was rescued by a man who was foraging nearby who heard the baby crying.
Okay.
So she didn't get run over by a train.
Jesus Christ.
Mm-hmm. And on the same day that she put her infant on the train, she also took an axe from someone's backyard and started waving it around town and threatening to kill random people she saw. Just ballistic. And there's not... So there was information about her childhood in Wikipedia. I didn't include any here because I couldn't find anywhere else that information was available.
Yeah.
But it is worth noting that on the Wikipedia information, it did say that she, like, her father was alcoholic abusive.
Okay.
Possibly raped her mother up to 10 times a day.
Oh, wow. Okay.
By, like, knife point or, like, intimidation. And also that she was a really well-mannered child. And she often got, like, good stuff for her good behavior and stuff in school up until she left at 16 to be an abattoir.
Mm-hmm.
But she also would go into, like, murderous rage, like, rampages, like, uncontrollable. And for very seemingly, like, minor things.
So very easy to set off. And once you set her off.
For nothing. Yeah, like, murdery. Like, she hurt people. Even as a child, like, it said on the Wikipedia page that she, like, assaulted a boy and a teacher actually hurt Catherine in self-defense.
Oh, okay.
At one point during school.
That sounds like something known as intermittent explosive disorder.
Yeah.
Which I think more likely occurs in kids and adolescents. And sometimes it's also in there with conduct disorder, emotional dysregulation, but it's what it sounds like.
Do they normally grow out of it?
Probably if they get help.
She didn't.
If they get help, maybe. Yeah. Yeah.
She didn't.
Yeah.
So she was arrested and taken to a hospital by police, and she was diagnosed with postnatal depression and released.
So fucking postpartum. They're just giving her postpartum. Like,
yes. Yeah. Yes. But tell me that's not standard practice for postpartum depression.
I don't know, because now I can't.
Especially after you tried to kill your baby.
I can't remember if that also came up with Andrea Yates's case. I feel like postpartum depression was in there, and she may very well have had it.
What bothers me about it is she has been displaying signs of mental health issues for years since she was a child. And they decided that since she had a baby, that must be it.
That obviously is what pushed her over the edge.
Makes women crazy, you know?
I guess I don't know enough about it.
It could have definitely contributed.
Yeah.
It could have contributed. Absolutely. But she was already, like, fucked before this.
Yeah. There was already some screws loose or misplaced.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, nonetheless, a few days go by, and then Catherine cuts a woman's face with a butcher's knife, a woman that she knew. And this woman narrowly escaped by pulling into a gas station. So I'm assuming that Catherine was in the car with her. They were going somewhere.
Oh,
and
okay,
she cut
her
with one of the knives that she always had on hand. By the time the police got to the gas station, Catherine had taken a young boy hostage at knife point. And another quick quiz for you, Amanda.
Hey.
The cops were actually able to wrestle the child away from her. But how did they do this? Was it attacking with mace? Attacking with riot batons? Attacking with brooms? Or attacking with ice?
Ice?
Brooms.
Damn. I was like, brooms is too obvious for some shenanigans. We're going to go with ice.
And it was. It was very obvious because they were apparently handy nearby and they just started whacking her with them. And she dropped the knife and she let the kid go. So it's a very interesting police tactic for taking down a hostage situation.
Like a bunch of chimney sweepers that came to the kid's rescue.
Police.
It's like, it's actually police.
It's police with brooms.
This is our police squad.
Yeah.
Yeah. They use brooms.
And I'm guessing they didn't want to shoot her for whatever reason. A small town, whatever.
Well, or they were worried about injuring the child.
I'd be worried about injuring the child if you let somebody with a knife. Like, if you hit me with a broom, I mean, it's going to hurt, but
yeah,
probably still get a few swings in.
As long as you don't get an eyeball somehow, it should be fine.
Yeah. Well, after this, a local doctor recommended that she be admitted to Morissette Psychiatric Hospital for treatment.
Good.
And detained under supervision while her daughter went to her grandparents, Barbara and Ken, which I'm not sure is better based on reading the Wikipedia article.
And now I'm thinking Barbie and Ken for Barbara and Ken.
It is. It's Barbie and Ken.
Barbie and Ken.
Well, now I'm going to refer to them like that.
Stacy? What was the teenage Barbie doll's name? Scooter? It wasn't Scooter.
No, it's Skipper.
Skipper, thank you. I was like, Stacy, Scooter.
Was her younger sister, I think.
Yeah.
Skipper.
Skipper.
Well, there's no Skipper here, just Barbie and Ken.
No.
The cops called David to let him know that his wife was locked up in New South Wales' most notorious mental institution. So he and his mother traveled to come be with Catherine. About, like I was saying, a couple hundred kilometers, couple hours drive.
Okay.
And she perked up as soon as she saw him.
Huh.
So she was then released later on August 9th, 1976, into her mother-in-law's care under the condition that Jean, the mother-in-law,
okay,
had to ensure that she was taking her medications. So that was one stipend to her release, which I don't know how you're going to make a crazy woman who attacks everybody with knives that she constantly has on her take her medication.
Good luck with that.
That should probably be being done by a professional.
Well, and how old is the mother-in-law, too? It's like...
probably in her 50s.
Yeah, maybe.
50s, 60s.
Yeah.
I don't know about you, but that's not somebody I want to care for.
Oh, God, no.
In my home, like in my own home, that sounds highly dangerous.
She's hanging her boning knives like everywhere.
Yeah. And especially because at this point, she has already like been hurting people her whole life in fits of rage. She tried to kill her baby and she cut a woman's face.
Yeah.
Possibly strangled her husband on their wedding night. Like, this woman has some serious like issues and violent issues. But nonetheless, off they went. And on the way, they picked up her daughter, Melissa, as well.
Oh, good.
So right back into
to
Catherine's care.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah.
I'm sure that was a good living situation for that child.
Mm-hmm.
Any of those children.
No. No. So now David and Catherine are back together with his mother and their child. And things didn't go well as Catherine flew into rages all the time over inconsequential stuff. She attacked David with her fists, kitchen appliances, really just anything she could grab and that was nearby. And yet they had another daughter in Natasha in March 1980.
Yay.
Yeah, let's just bring more kids into this situation.
Yeah.
It's going to be
perfect.
Pleasant.
Kids thrive in domestic violence situations.
Yeah. Oh, especially this one.
It's necessary for their development.
Especially this one. But, you know, they had their next kid. 1984 rolls around, and I'm sure to David's relief, she disappears. Catherine disappears. However, she took her two daughters with her.
Aw, damn.
And everything from the house that she could.
Okay.
Yep.
Okay.
So then she went to her parents' farm in Aberdeen, but that didn't last very long, and she moved into Musselbrook. And after about a year, her hard labor job, which was 12 hours a day of hacking up carcasses, like bent over and stuff, took its toll and her back gave out.
Oh, okay.
And she stopped working entirely.
Yeah.
So the housing commission gave her a house and she had her pension as an income. And she was just 30 at this time. So 30 years old.
Yeah. Living on a pension, not able to work anymore, probably in pain.
Yeah. Just great, great combinations of things here.
Yeah.
It's kind of like ticks all of the like trauma boxes.
Yeah. Yeah. Ticking time bomb.
Mm-hmm. But she still needed a man. So she got to work on that. And she was a fairly attractive woman.
Sure.
Tall, thin. And her next relationship that stuck was with Dave Saunders. He was a 38-year-old miner, and Catherine was very cheerful and fun when she needed to be. So he was easy to seduce. She had very nice feminine wiles. Oh, and a really high sex drive.
I wonder if she almost has this
like cute and like pretty, wearing skirts, dressing up.
Yes.
Yeah.
Like she's got that. And then is she kind of acting almost like a giddy little girl? Like silly, like almost like regresses developmentally. Yeah.
Till you get home.
Yeah.
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 So he loved her and he moved in with her and her daughters after a few months. Things went south from there. She was always falsely accusing him of cheating. She would throw him out. He would return to the apartment that he kept when he moved in with her. And then she would come back and beg for forgiveness. And he always went back.
Okay.
So just an endless cycle of domestic abuse, basically, because she beat the shit out of people all the time.
Yeah.
Now, I just want to let you know that this next part involves animals. So.
Oh, great.
Yeah, it's not pleasant.
Okay.
So not only would she attack Dave with her fists and her boots, but in May 1987, she also decided to show him what would happen if he messed around on her. So she took his two-month-old puppy and slit its throat from ear to ear with one of her prized boning knives.
Yeah.
And after that, she took a frying pan and bludgeoned the puppy until it was unconscious.
Jesus Christ.
Yep.
Yeah. I'm not surprised. Just with her history, her work, her
rampant
love of that kind of shit.
Bodies.
Yeah.
Cutting meat.
Carcasses. Slaughtering
carcasses.
Things. Yeah.
It's nothing to her to put a knife in something and slide it through. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So even through all of this and a suicide attempt by Catherine, Dave still loved her. And in June 1987, they had a baby girl named Sarah.
Dave.
Just one more kid.
You need some counseling. I mean, she needs a lot. But like,
this woman needed to be in a padded room. She needed to be put away.
Yeah.
Medication, heavy medication.
Yes. Yes.
And she went through a lot as a child, allegedly.
Yeah.
It was later stated in like court documents that she had been raped multiple times by multiple family members throughout her childhood. I think up until she was like 11, but not by her father.
Okay.
And court psychiatrists didn't really know if they like believed that, but the family members actually said that the abuse did happen.
Oh, okay.
So they're not really sure exactly about the details that she gave, but she was abused.
Something was going on.
Yes.
And then we know she witnessed ongoing domestic violence with her parents.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah.
It's a perfect storm for her to hate men.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Very much so. So after the birth of Sarah, things settled down for a while. Dave bought a small house in Aberdeen for them, and Catherine paid it off with her workers' comp that came through in 1989.
Damn.
Yeah, she was doing all right.
She's doing okay, yeah.
It was pretty, like, serious job back then, abattoirs.
Okay, yeah.
And this was Catherine's, like, real first possession in her life that she owned.
Okay.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It was hers.
Yeah.
So she decorated just as she liked. With dead animals.
Oh, great.
Yep. The walls of the home were covered in animal hides. There were lots of things hanging from the ceilings, like old bear traps and pitchforks and riding jackets, like motorcycle jackets.
Oh, okay.
And then old newspapers took up pretty much the rest of the home's space. So, bit of a hoarder. Some strange decorations going on.
Yeah, a little bit of a slaughter shack she's got.
For sure.
Going with a hermit, sprinkling a hermit in there.
Yeah. So even though this was, you know, her dream home, she had her new daughter, she still fell into her normal, uncontrollable rages. And she allegedly hit Dave with a frying pan and stabbed him with some scissors in the chest.
Shit.
So, yeah. She'd still stick around, though. It's going to be great. Everything will be better. After a particularly nasty fight, Dave left and returned a week later to find all of his clothes shredded and thrown away. And this was like the end of the line for Dave.
Okay.
Dave was like, nope, I'm done.
So she can kill his puppy.
Yep.
She can hit him constantly. She can hit him with a frying pan, stab him with scissors.
Yep.
You destroy this man's clothes.
It's over.
You have gone too far.
Yep.
It's over.
Yep.
You mess with my Levi's and my Wranglers. We're done.
Yeah. Well, that was the straw that broke the camel's back. I don't know. Man put up with a lot.
Yeah. Yeah.
He hopped from bar to bar, his favorite drinking places. His friends knew where he was, but no one would tell Catherine. Not a soul.
Oh, okay, good.
So after some time of searching, she gave up because nobody was going to tell her where he was. So a few months later, he came back to see his daughter and realized that Catherine had gone to the cops and complained that she was afraid that he would come back and hurt them. So they issued an order and he was not allowed anywhere near her or the children.
Yep.
With no proof. Like,
depending on the story she's concocted.
Everybody in the town knows she's nuts. She is infamous in town. But still, for some reason, the man's the one doing the domestic abuse.
Well, because I wonder if there's still some disconnect of men being able to be abused.
Oh, 100% back then?
Like, I wonder if that's still just too much of a disconnect, even if they know this woman's batshit crazy, like certifiable, needs to be in a hospital.
He could do something about it if he wanted to.
Yeah, he's obviously beating her if there's any domestic violence going on, which is bullshit. Mm-hmm. But
yeah. So not long after this, she found a new lover. A few months after that, she was pregnant again.
God damn.
I know. It's a lot of kids. So the baby's father was John Chillingworth, and he was 43, worked at the meatworks, and the baby was born in 1991.
Okay.
This relationship lasted 3 years and ended with her dumping John Chillingworth for John Price. And let's just say that this was a very, very unfortunate thing for John Price.
Okay, yeah.
And also, apparently, her and John Price had been having an affair for some time before this. So they already knew each other and were already fucking around.
Oh, and she dumped Chillingworth.
Yes.
So.
Which is a first.
Yeah. Yeah. She's got another man lined up. That's what she does. She has to have a man in her life. If she knows she's getting sick of Chillingworth, I got to line someone up first.
Mm-hmm.
So that was probably a very intentional move by her.
Yeah. And John Chillingworth got away, turned his life around, stopped drinking, like, did pretty okay for himself.
Good for John. Good for that, John.
Yeah, good job, John. John Price was not going to be as lucky.
Okay.
So he was known around town as being a great guy who would give you, like, the shirt off of his back. Everyone liked him. Just nice guy.
Yeah.
He'd been married before. That ended in 1988. He was left with a teenage boy and a girl to take care of. And they lived in a very nice brick bungalow and wanted for nothing due to his position at the mine. So he was making bank. He was doing good for himself and his kids.
Yeah.
They were good. So he met Catherine in 1993 when they were both 38. And he had already heard all the rumors about her and how she abused her lovers. And he ignored that and dove in anyway. Mm-hmm. But as with every relationship before, it didn't take long for things to fall apart and go into the same pattern that she always went into.
Yeah.
So she accused him of infidelity.
Yep.
They would fight. He would leave. He would come back. And the cycle would start again.
Oh, God.
So just over and over.
Yeah. I almost wonder, like, if she has some version of the Madonna whore complex, but for men. And I think it exists, where it's like knight in shining armor and then you're a failure, you're weak.
Kind of reminds me of Eileen Wuornos.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, not exactly the same, but like a hatred for men.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it's the same story every time. She plays it out the same way, no matter the man in her life.
Yeah.
So it's all about whatever her internal rhetoric is about men, whether they're trustworthy, whether they're going to leave you. It's like she wants one really badly.
And I mean, let's be honest, with her dad, like, growing up, it makes sense why she doesn't trust men.
Well, and with the abuse from family members, if she's also being sexually abused by family members, like, I can't trust any man. Mm-hmm. All they want is sex. But I still want that relationship.
I'm still
going to seek it out.
Yeah.
I'm going to be very sexually driven because that was what was done to me. So that's what I...
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Abuse begets abuse.
It does. And it fucks with your sexuality. So sometimes there's a sense of, like, sex is the one thing that's going to keep the relationship together.
Yeah, that's fair. Well, in 1995, she moved in with him. They both drank heavily. They fought out in front of any establishment, wherever they were. Things would be fine one second, and then they were at each other's throats the next second.
Okay.
So everybody knew.
And they're those people. They're that couple.
Yep. Everybody knew. It was way out in the open. They fought all the time.
Yeah.
In 1998, she showed a video of some items that Pricey had stolen from work to his boss. And she said that she had recorded this as revenge for his refusal to marry her. And initially, she had planned on using it as blackmail. But after a fight got particularly heated and he beat her with a belt, she decided to take it further.
Okay.
And these were items that were past their due date that had been salvaged from a bin.
Oh.
But this was enough that the company fired him.
Oh, God. Okay.
And this was a job that he had loved for 17 years.
Well, and their livelihood.
And their livelihood. Exactly. So Pricey kicked her out and she fled back to her little shack of horrors. And word spread around town about how fucking just awful she had been. And it surprised nobody.
Yeah. Okay.
So nobody batted an eye.
But there are no charges being pressed. Nope. The men aren't taking out orders of protection against her or anything like that. Yeah.
Not yet.
Okay.
So Pricey took her back a few months later, although he would not move her back into his home. He lost a lot of friends who would be nowhere near him if she was anywhere around. Just did not want to.
Understandably, yeah.
I mean, 100%. Yeah. So they resumed fighting, and he would bring up her getting him fired from the mine. Everyone knew they were awful for each other, but they just couldn't be apart.
Yeah.
And from some recollections of people, it seemed like they were like, it was just not out of the ordinary. It was a pretty typical relationship. So apparently this was pretty, like, common for the area. Like, fights and...
The fuck?
I mean, it's a mining town.
Sure, okay, yeah. Or they're used to some level of domestic abuse.
Yes. Guess,
which is...
Yes. It's true. You know?
Yeah.
So, going forward from here, she was allowed back into his home. Fights escalated again. And in February 2000, she stabbed him in the chest with a knife during an argument. So, he went to court. Got an order to keep her away from his home.
Yes. Good job.
The same day that he got this order, he was in bed at 11 p.m. after visiting with some neighbors. Catherine pulled into the driveway, went in, watched TV for a few minutes, and then took a shower. And then she joined him in bed and they had sex.
Good Lord, buddy.
You just got an order of protection against her.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, hey, baby.
I mean, she's using sex as a weapon, kind of a means of controlling these men.
Very much so.
Too.
Very much so.
Yeah.
Well, they had sex. The next day, neighbors noticed that his truck hadn't left for work, as it usually would have been gone by then.
Yeah.
I guess he got another job. His employer also expressed concern, and neighbors went to his bedroom window. They knocked. They went to his front door, and that's where they saw a small amount of blood. They called the police.
Okay.
So police arrived around 8 a.m. They broke in through the back door, and when they got in there, they saw something they would never, never be able to forget. And that was some of Pricey's skin hanging from hooks in the archway doorway to the lounge.
Oh, great.
Uh-huh.
Great.
They found Pricey in the lounge on the floor, decapitated in a lot of blood.
Yeah.
As they searched the house further, they found Catherine snoring loudly on a double bed at the other end of the house. She was removed by police and taken to a hospital, and she was in a coma-like sleep.
Huh.
Like, couldn't wake her. She was done. You'll find out why.
Okay.
And the following information is from a written record of the detective who was the first officer on the scene after the body was discovered.
Yeah.
Now you think, okay, dead guy, no head, skin hanging. Yo, this dude's been butchered and that's pretty awful, but you know, that's it.
Sure.
Not even close.
Okay.
There's a lot.
Yeah.
So Detective Peter Anthony Musio walked into the yard and saw a cooked piece of meat in the lawn. And it was collected for analysis. Didn't know what kind of meat it was. It's bad when you can't tell what kind of meat.
I know what kind of meat it is already. Just what's going on?
I know
what that shit is.
She raises her hand. I know what kind of meat it is.
I know what kind of meat.
Uh-huh. So he went in through the rear door and then he saw the human skin hanging in the doorway. And he described the skin as hanging from the archway to the floor. And it appeared to be a whole human skin. Intact.
Oh.
Uh-huh. So.
So the skin suit.
Mm-hmm. So Peter went into the lounge, Detective Peter, and he saw the headless and skinless body and a lot of blood. Some was smeared on the wall, just everywhere. He also went into the dining area, found a table set with placements for three, and clothes had been draped over the chair backs. Don't know why.
Okay.
There was also a tool bag on the table with a folder, a toy gorilla, and prescription medicine boxes. So like a bunch of empty boxes of medicines.
Okay.
Those medicines were Felodur ER, 5 milligrams. Two boxes were empty, which is used for hypertension. An empty box of 20 milligram Prindivil, which is also used for high blood pressure.
Okay.
An empty box of Dapatabs. If this were a full box, it contained 90 tabs at 2.5 milligrams each, also for hypertension. So Peter went to the human pelt and noticed that it had hair, like black curly hair.
Yeah.
Pubic hair on the full pelts. The edges were really smooth and had been done with a very, very sharp instrument.
Yeah.
And there were also several stab wounds in the pelt.
Yeah.
I love calling it a pelt.
Yeah. Yeah. That's what it is.
It's not on our person anymore.
Yeah. No.
So this is when Peter noticed blood leading into the kitchen and the stovetop near the aluminum broiler. The stove was off, but when he lifted the lid, he noticed that the pot was still warm. In the pot was a human head and veggies.
Great.
Uh-huh. There was also a baking dish with the remains of veggies and some liquid. There were also two meals with meat, potatoes, pumpkin, zucchini, cabbage, squash, and gravy. And the meat was similar to what was found in the yard.
Yeah. Okay.
No shit.
Yeah.
There were also more medication boxes around. One for Luvox, which is used to treat OCD.
Yeah.
And it is an antidepressant SSRI.
Yeah.
And one for Aeropax, which is also an SSRI. And then promethazine, which is used for allergies and nausea or also as a sedative.
Okay.
So this is why Catherine was in a coma-like state. She had taken a lot of pills.
Shit ton of meds.
Mm-hmm. Can't kill that bitch, though. There was blood in the fridge, on the handle, all over the kitchen. microwave was open. Some cooking and smoking of cigarettes had happened in there.
Okay.
For some time.
Yeah.
Peter then investigated the body, and there was almost no skin. Exposed muscle and organs and many stab wounds on the left side of the chest.
Jesus.
The meat that was served was pieces of Pricey's butt. And the plates were intended for her and his two children when they came home.
Okay.
She was going to feed him to his kids.
Yep.
I mean, she kind of left a mess, though, so I don't know if they really would have been like, okay, let's eat dinner.
Hopefully they would have first been very concerned and not had an appetite and gotten the fuck out of there. Second, I would hope they would be like, we're not eating our dad. It's obvious you're trying to feed him to
us. He was in the living room on the floor, headless,
his skinless. Skin is hanging.
I'm not going to eat that.
We're not stupid.
You're out of your damn mind.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Detective Peter stated that everywhere he walked in the hallway was shoulder high with blood. It was apparent that Pricey had fought each stab, and he had attempted to turn on a light. He had even made it to the front door and opened it, but the screen door was closed and there was blood on it. So he died right there.
Yeah.
And then there was obvious drag marks where she had moved the body into the middle of the room.
Okay.
So he was skinned fully, avoiding the nose, ears, and genital areas. And according to a forensic pathologist, this would have taken about 40 minutes with how skilled the killer was.
Okay.
Catherine was questioned, but denied having any recollection of what happened after they had had sex. So none. No recollection.
And yet you expertly skinned this person.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
After she recovered from an alleged suicide attempt, which was the swallowing of all the pills, she was charged with John Price's murder at a hearing that they actually held at her bedside in a psychiatric wing.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So they took a special trip.
Yeah.
To charge her with his murder. And it was discovered that after she had murdered John, she went to town and withdrew $1,000 from his bank account. Can't remember it, though.
Okay. Okay.
She killed him.
Yeah.
Cleaned up. Left.
Went to town.
Got money from his bank account. Came back. Skinned him.
I got some errands to run. I got to put this on pause for a few minutes.
Yeah. Yeah. So in 2001, Catherine originally pled not guilty, but then changed her plea to guilty to spare the family of having to hear all of the details of the murder.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Which is interesting.
Yeah.
And according to court psychiatrists, she was perfectly sane when she committed the murder.
Yeah.
Perfectly sane.
Yeah.
On November 8th, she was sentenced to life in prison with no chance of parole. The judge made it clear that her papers were to be marked never to be released.
Good.
And she appealed the severity of the sentence, which is crazy to me, because you literally skinned a man, like a whole man, and cooked him.
Yeah.
And tried to feed him to children.
But she doesn't remember.
Fuck you. And it was unclear if Catherine had eaten any of the parts of John that she had cooked. It was hard to tell. They couldn't really tell if all of his pieces were.
I bet she.
She had. She tried that
shit. I bet she ate a little.
She tried it.
She tried it.
But you couldn't tell because, I mean, he had been heavily mutilated.
Yeah.
And to this day, she still maintains that she remembers them having sex, climaxing. He went to pee. She watched him come back and they fell asleep. And she is still locked up and in her 60s now.
Great.
Yeah. Yeah. So to me, sounds like bitch knew what she was doing.
Well, for like, I get that maybe she could have taken a lot of the meds post-coitus after sex.
Yeah, but they were in a tool bag on the dining table and in the kitchen mixed along with like a bunch of blood and stuff.
Well, she was able to skin him expertly, decapitate him, cook a 3-course meal using human meat. The people I've seen that are so fucked up out of their minds on like benzos or alcohol, they can barely make a grilled cheese. Like, no.
Yeah.
No.
And I mean, this was done with skill. Like yeah. She was known in the area for being like really fucking good at her job. Really good at it.
Yeah. And she can't do that kind of job if she's that fucked up.
No, so. Because you start to lose control of your muscles. Like it would have been like shittily done.
Yeah.
You know, there would have been mistakes and stuff. No, she did a full, like when I say a full human skin, I mean entirely intact.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
Like that's pretty impressive. Like not impressive, but.
Well, and that means she's like peeling it. You know, the whole thing.
And not to be disgusting, but there are layers underneath the skin of fibers and muscles and stuff like that that attach. And you have to cut away as you're pulling back.
Yes.
To be able to skin something. So this was done meticulously, moment by moment with her precious boning knives.
Yes. Yes.
Yep. And that's it. So thank you guys for joining us. This one was a doozy.
Yeah.
If you have any feedback, you can leave a review or send us a message on social media or at our website, which is simply terrible people doing terrible things, wordpress.com. And remember, terrible people are everywhere.
Yep. And you might just be one of them. Bye.